It's Flaves, and this is Climate Changers, a podcast where we celebrate the heroes who are on the front lines of creating a new and sustainable resource and energy economy. Today, my guest is Rich Bradbury, a thought leader and rancher who is an independent voice in the regenerative agriculture movement. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
What role do you see farmers and ranchers playing in the restoration of our soils and the fight against climate change?
I think I should preface it by saying I think it's going to be big. But I would say I think it's going to be big for a reason other than what people think. When I started exploring regenerative agriculture about three years ago, coming close to four, the thing that drew me to it was you have all these claims about climate and how different mechanisms, different industries influence it. And for the first time in the regenerative agriculture, like with Will Harris and White Oaks Pastures or Farms, there was a path, even though it might be a little bit vague, as to where I, on my personal operation, could help have a positive impact on climate change. Now, there's a lot of controversy that goes around that statement, being as I raise cattle, but I feel that the offsets of the ecological good that we're able to do with the cattle, let alone the placeholder that the cattle present that stops development, probably more impactful, or even conventional farming, more that type of impactful ecological management, sort of negative impacts. I think that cattle, while demonized, can also be a positive path forward if managed correctly. And I'm perfectly aware that to some that might sound like a contradictory statement, given there's just so many angles that you can look at the climate change issue. So I'm trying to be sympathetic to all arguments.
And taking a step back, a lot of people are really struggling to define regenerative agriculture itself. As a producer, what's your definition?
I honestly think we're going to work through this, but I think that it's become a victim of its trendiness right now. And there's a number of people that get a good emotional feeling out of narrowly defining it. But I have evolved my thinking to believe that regenerative agriculture is a big tent. I like to call it a big church because it's almost sort of a dogma, but it's a positive one that'll move people forward. And so, like, I don't think it should be narrowly defined right away. I think anybody that wants to make a positive change, they might not make the complete conversion, but as long as they're making that evolution to be more regenerative, I think that as long as they continue to act in good faith, they should be able to say, yeah, I'm working on regenerative agriculture. And agriculture is such a complex and diverse thing. It's really hard to narrowly define what it is. And I think that once you narrowly define what regenerative agriculture is right now, that you run the possibility of deterring people from entering into it, because eventually, as it gets more myopic from the fans and everybody that is rooting for it, you start to turn off producers because they start to see a path that is economically isn't feasible. So if we're going to make this big, huge shift, not only for our climate, but for more nutritional foods, I think that we have to keep in mind that it's going to be something that happens incrementally over time. And to not shut down people that are trying to make positive movements to regenerative agriculture by narrowly defining it might not be advantageous to the greater movement as a whole. I sort of inherited a legacy of regenerative agriculture because of the nature of our climate. So I actively managed to maintain that, but other people in different places have more water. They have different capacities on their operations. And so what may be regenerative for me may not be what their regenerative actions look like for them. So I think just keep it sort of broad for now until people start making the transition. And I think economically, once they start making the transition, you'll just see more and more movement towards a more holistic regenerative practice across their operation.
So as you talk about this movement and it having a big tent or a big church, there's a lot of people in the movement who aren't actually, you know, working the soil. And you released what you're calling a dirt under your fingernails heuristic. What does that mean?
I've been going to seminars and talking to different people about regenerative agriculture and how I see it working for farmers and ranchers. And I love the discussion, but I often find that I have to invite myself, get myself there and participate. And then when I do get there, to give the perspective of a rancher, there's very few other producers there. So you could have 100 people in a conversation about regenerative agriculture and only have 4 or 5 producers in the entire room. One might be a beekeeper. One might raise some specialty crops on a small acreage. One guy might raise wheat in Montana, and another guy like myself might be in grass-fed. So there's all these people that are trying to make a positive work, but so much of the conversation is going on without the input of producers. And what I see is some of these regenerative companies that offer services or service companies to help people transition into regenerative agriculture will sort of find a like-minded farmer or rancher and develop a plan. Well, that's really good, but it's not very diverse and it doesn't work for everybody. So I use Will Harris, and I have a tremendous amount of respect for Will Harris on the East Coast and everything that he's done with White Oaks Pastures. I've talked to him several times. Beyond the regenerative, he has the economic viability of his local county in mind. He has a whole list of positive attributes that he's trying to create with White Oak Pasture that goes far beyond the regenerative component of it. But the difference between what he does regeneratively is he gets 70 to 80 inches of rain a year, whereas on my operation, I get 7 to 10 if I'm lucky. So just by the nature of our climate and the nature of our location and region, it's going to be a different conversation because we have different contexts. So I think as people talk about regenerative agriculture, especially in their regions, they really need to saturate those conversations with a diverse amount of producers that are on the ground, and they should facilitate lower cost meetings or better times to have the meetings where they can include the maximum amount of producers. And the other thing I also find sort of a barrier is a lot of people will create standards and market them and then expect farmers and ranchers to follow them. But those people have no stake or take no risk in what they're asking the farmers and ranchers to do. So I think that there just needs to be a greater conversation. And I don't think standards should be created in the vacuum in the absence of producers. It doesn't matter how much it helps the retailer or how much it helps somebody market their product. If you're creating standards and policies without the input of the people on the ground or their ability to appeal or be part of that bigger conversation and making those guidelines, then I think they're sort of disingenuous and mostly a profit motivation for the people that created them. Also, I think that a lot of people create these things so that they can be involved, because access to agricultural land, and there's a great amount of passion for people that want to start regenerative farms and that kind of stuff. But the barriers, there's mostly cost, and then there's some cultural barriers and that kind of stuff. People want to get into regenerative agriculture, so they create different services and different type of businesses to be part of it. But in the end, most of those are geared towards extracting money from the farmers and ranchers who already live on tight margins and already one of the lowest medium income classes in the United States.
Well, in full disclosure, I am one of those people who does not have dirt under my fingernails, yet cares deeply about climate and soils and believes regen ag is critical to our success. What can someone like me do to be an authentic and effective part of this movement and help remove some of those barriers?
I always encourage people first to go out and start learning about the ag producers in their region. Go and talk to them, tour their places. I've never really run across a farmer or rancher that's not willing to be transparent and show you everything that they're working on. And I think you'll find that some people that wouldn't claim that their farm or ranch is regenerative have regenerative practices on it. So that'd be one of the first things I would do. And then my other thing is, if you have a special skill or particular talent that you could bring to bear, like doing a podcast and talking to different people, I think that's critically important to create a platform or to provide the service that would help a farmer and rancher either capture a better market or find a more favorable position. One of the biggest drawbacks, I think, to all of regenerative agriculture and a lot of things that I spend a lot of time working on is finding non-traditional, unconventional financing structures so that we can pull off some of these regenerative agriculture transitions, because really sometimes in an operation with low margins, the biggest barrier to working towards a regenerative goal is financing.
So Rich, you've been ranching for a while and even selling premium beef. What's different about your new venture in Desert Mountain, and why the move in that direction?
I absolutely love to tell this story. And this is some of the stuff I earlier talked about, my thinking has evolved. In the 80s, after my parents had gone to the original Savory Institute down in New Mexico, they came back and got together with a lot of other ranchers that had gone to the Savory Institute. And they developed a co-op to sell natural beef, which originally started out as being hormone-free, then evolved to be antibiotic-free. And it was a product that was still produced in feedlots, but with a lot of emphasis on trying to reduce the amount of time that they were in the feedlot, really focus on the feeds that they were being fed, like non-GMO, that kind of stuff. But while there's still a market for that in a lot of grocery stores, because it's still, I think, superior to the conventional products, the customer base kept clamoring and moving. They sort of wanted to move on to grass-fed. So it's a huge logistical challenge. It's a huge economical challenge to take on the extra burden of owning that calf for another 10 to 12 months after you normally would have already marketed it. So it's basically cost you twice as much to bring a grass-fed animal to market as it does what a conventional animal would take. So we started Desert Mountain Beef with the intention to try and tackle some of the challenges that made grass-fed beef prohibitive. So we used the co-op model that we had in the previous group, but added a couple twists to it. One is all the original second round sort of partners that joined Desert Mountain Beef own a stake in the company. And then the other thing that's different is we didn't just include ranchers. We also include the farmers that produce the pasture that we graze the cattle on. What's evolved over time is we've created incentives for farmers to create cover crops and provide them an extra line of revenue for those cover crops, where in the past that might not have been so advantageous. They might have created a cover crop for their soil health, but never were really getting a good payout for it. So by including the cattle into the equation, we can add another revenue stream that adds another $200 to $300 per acre for those farmers in a time when they wouldn't normally be generating revenue. So it's an economic model to encourage them to put those cover crops in and then have a viable way for them to harvest it through the grass-fed cattle, which I think I'd like to say that's how we planned it. And I'm sure to a little bit, but had no idea how big of an impact it was going to have. And my favorite story is just recently, we were actually contacted by a group of farmers in Kansas that had been studying and really trying to apply some of Gabe Brown's no-till methods and sort of his regenerative agriculture outlook on the farming side. And they contacted us because they knew that we would provide cattle for cover crops and that. And so they contacted us to partner, and it just sort of worked really well since part of the Desert Mountain Beef is in the Denver area. And one of the things we're working to do there is really create a local food shed for all the Whole Foods and specialty markets in Denver. And so the cow will be grown regionally, I mean, within 200 miles or so. All those cattle will then come back to Denver, and that's where they'll be consumed. So we're closing that circle, that regional circle, and having that supply chain be able to service just that metropolitan area. So we're pretty excited about that. And we have a saying in our groups that it's a process, not an event. And why I think a lot of people get a lot of publicity for the events, they don't get celebrated much for the process. And really the process is where all the innovation comes from.
What positive role could or should third-party certifiers play in regenerative agriculture?
So I'll disclose, I complain a lot about them, but I do the non-GMO certification and I do the GAP certification. So I do believe that there is a path for certifiers, but I don't believe that there's a path for 25 different certifiers. And I honestly think that the USDA is gearing up to sort of clamp down on them. I believe, regardless of what a certifier will tell you, I believe that there's a lot of certification for profit schemes. it's a good way to make money off of farmers and ranchers and create a little market and have some influence. But I think enough is enough, and certification is just getting out of hand. It has to be advantageous for the largest group of people. And I think that it's just dangerous for these certifications to splinter people in agriculture down along certification lanes. So I think that there needs to be a certification of some sort. It needs to be cohesive and it needs to be broad. And the more that we fracturize this, the more that I think we're hurting the overall regenerative agriculture movement. And I think that any certification that takes power, disproportionate power, based on the investment and the risk they're taking from those that are taking the risk and making the investment is a poorly thought out certification. I'm not too interested in partnering with certifications that don't return some sort of a tangible process. Nobody ever guarantees you a profit if you join the certification. They just say, maybe there will be one. I don't see it as a market differentiator like a lot of certification companies. I just see it as a cost center. I really hate writing checks to certifiers.
What's the potential scale of regenerative carbon sucking farming? Is this just a niche, a whole new way of farming, or something in between?
I think it's huge. And I think the biggest drawback right now is how people envision regenerative agriculture. I think that everybody pictures as these idyllic farmscapes where there's 60 acres and the family and they're cultivating cabbage and corn and everything. And that's a small view of what regenerative agriculture could be. Just this week, I read an article about a guy that has transitioned 7,000 acres over into regenerative agriculture. Now, that's a huge change. That creates economy of scale and it creates efficiencies and it really shows that it's possible. And like, we struggle with what regenerative is, but if you look at all the cattle that go through our grass-fed program, that's 3,000 head of cattle that come from ranches that can economically and sustainably support those cattle. And we create a lot of economy of scale that allows us to market them to a greater percentage of the population. So I think that for regenerative agriculture to really succeed, it needs to be scalable. And I think that a lot of changes in practices can be scalable and can make a tremendous amount of difference in how much land can be, quote unquote, regeneratively managed. Like I said before, it's a process and not an event. It's not going to be all overnight. It's going to be 10 to 20 years. But I think that if we keep working people towards those positive steps, that the transformation will be amazing.
What's the most important thing that needs to happen next to achieve that scale so regenerative beef can get bigger?
There needs to be a change in the financing. The American farm credit system is basically one government agency called Farmer Mac that deals with all farm financing. Any bank that finances you will get their majority of them will get their capital from Farmer Mac. And that is sort of controlled by the USDA, and the USDA has a very specific way of looking at how agriculture should work and able to create the most stability in agriculture. And for a government entity like the USDA to just pivot and adapt regenerative agriculture, it's not going to happen. No government agency turns that quickly. So I think that the USDA is looking at regenerative agriculture, but they haven't bought in on it completely. So in that case, it affects what kind of risks the lenders are able to take. So the USDA and agriculture lenders want people to stay in the pre-established lanes. So it's tremendously difficult to go out and get financing for something that doesn't fit in the box that the government has pictured for how we maintain agricultural stability in the United States. There's going to have to be a conscious shift to not finance detrimental practices, but start rewarding people with easy access to capital that are doing the right thing. I think that we live in a culture where everybody tries to sort of keep a certain level of decorum and get along. And I encourage that, but I think for regenerative agriculture to work, that we're going to have to be able to be comfortable with a certain level of healthy conflict, because agriculture is just 1.8% of the population. And the people that care about their food are the other 98% or the other 100%. And they have very strong desires as to what they want to see out of their food system that may not necessarily dovetail into what is immediately possible. So I think that there needs to be a certain amount of understanding that transitions can be made, but we're going to have to talk about it and do real practical transitions, not just ideological changes. People that go into regenerative agriculture and care about creating a better food system need to be comfortable with a little bit of healthy conflict so that we can build a workable system for everybody that checks all those boxes that us as a society need to accomplish so that we can have healthy food, a better climate, and a real secure agricultural system.
Rich, thank you for your innovative work as a businessman, thought leader, and rancher. And thank you for joining this episode of Climate Changers.
Well, I appreciate you having me.
Every episode of Climate Changers has a call to action posted in the show notes. Each call to action has been curated to make it easy for you to help create the changes that we discussed today. Thank you for joining Climate Changers. Until next time.